Chapter 7. As he had not seen me, then stopped and called the dog to her several times, but he only nestled closer to my side, and when I tried to push him away developed that remarkable power of internal resistance by which a dog makes himself practically immovable by anything short of a kick. She looked over her shoulder and her arched eyebrows frowned above her blanched face. It was almost a scowl. Then the expression changed. She looked unhappy. "Omir," she cried once more in an angry and distressed tone. I took off my hat at last, but the dog hanging out his tongue with that cheerfully imbecile expression some dogs know so well how to put on when it suits their purpose, pretended to be deaf. She cried from the distance desperately. "Perhaps you will take him to the cottage then. I can't wait. I won't be responsible for that dog," I protested, getting down the bank and advancing towards her. She looked very hurt, apparently by the desertion of the dog. "But if you let me walk with you, he will follow us all right," I suggested. She moved on without answering me. The dog launched himself suddenly full speed down the road, receding from us in a small cloud of dust. It vanished in the distance, and presently we came up with him lying on the grass. He panted in the shade of the hedge with shining eyes, but pretended not to see us. We had not exchanged a word so far. The girl by my side gave him a scornful glance in passing. "He offered to come with me," she remarked bitterly. "And then abandoned you." I sympathized. "He looks very unchivalrous. But that's merely his want of tact. I believe he meant to protest against your reckless proceedings. What made you come so near the edge of that quarry? The earth might have given way. Haven't you noticed a smashed fir tree at the bottom? Tumbled over only the other morning after a night's rain. I don't see why I shouldn't be as reckless as I please." I was nettled by her brusque manner of asserting her folly, and I told her that neither did I as far as that went, in a tone which almost suggested that she was welcome to break her neck for all I cared. This was considerably more than I meant, but I don't like rude girls. I had been introduced to her only the day before at the round tea table, and as he had barely acknowledged the introduction. I had not caught her name, but I had noticed her fine, arched eyebrows which, so the physiognomists say, are a sign of courage. I examined her appearance quietly. Her hair was nearly black, her eyes blue, deeply shaded by long dark eyelashes. As he had a little color now. She looked straight before her, the corner of her lip on my side drooped a little, her chin was fine, somewhat pointed. I went on to say that some regard for others should stand in the way of one's playing with danger. I urged playfully the distress of the poor finds in case of accident, if nothing else. I told her that she did not know the bucolic mind. Had she given occasion for a coroner's inquest, the verdict would have been suicide, with the implication of unhappy love. They would never be able to understand that as he had taken the trouble to climb over two post and rail fences only for the fun of being reckless. Indeed, even as I talked chaffingly, I was greatly struck myself by the fact. She retorted that once one was dead, what horrid people thought of one did not matter. It was said with infinite contempt, but something like a suppressed quaver in the voice made me look at her again. I perceived then that her thick eyelashes were wet. This surprising discovery silenced me, as you may guess. She looked unhappy, and I don't know how to say it well, it suited her. The clouded brow, the pained mouth, the vague fixed glance. A victim. And this characteristic aspect made her attractive. An individual touch, you know. The dog had run on ahead and now gazed at us by the side of the Fine's garden gate in a tense attitude, and wagging his stumpy tail very, very slowly, with an air of concentrated attention. The girlfriend of the Fine's bolted violently through the aforesaid gate, and into the cottage, leaving me on the road astounded. A couple of hours afterwards I returned to the cottage for chess as usual. I saw neither the girl nor Mrs. Fine then. We had our two games, and on parting I warned Fine that I was called to town on business, and might be away for some time. He regretted it very much. His brother-in-law was expected next day, but he didn't know whether he was a chess player. Captain Anthony, the son of the poet you know, was of a retiring disposition, shy with strangers, unused to society, and very much devoted to his calling, Fine explained. All the time they had been married, he could be induced only once before to come and stay with them for a few days. He had had a rather unhappy boyhood, and it made him a silent man. But no doubt, concluded Fine, as if dealing portentously with a mystery, we two sailors should find much to say to one another. This point was never settled. I was detained in town from week to week till it seemed hardly worth while to go back. But as I had kept on my rooms in the farmhouse, I concluded to go down again for a few days. It was late, deep dusk, when I got out at our little country station. My eyes fell on the unmistakable broad back and the muscular legs in cycling stockings of little Fine. He passed along the carriages rapidly towards the rear of the train, which presently pulled out and left him solitary at the end of the rustic platform. When he came back to where I waited, I perceived that he was much perturbed, so perturbed as to forget the convention of the usual greetings. He only exclaimed, "Oh!" on recognizing me, and stopped irresolute. When I asked him if he had been expecting somebody by that train, he didn't seem to know. He stammered disconnectedly. I looked hard at him. To all appearances, he was perfectly sober. Moreover, to suspect Fine of a lapse from the proprieties, high or low, great or small, was absurd. He was also a too serious and deliberate person to go mad suddenly. But as he seemed to have forgotten that he had a tongue in his head, I concluded I would leave him to his mystery. To my surprise, he followed me out of the station and kept by my side, though I did not encourage him. I did not, however, repulse his attempts at conversation. He was no longer expecting me, he said. He had given me up. The weather had been uniformly fine and so on. I gathered also that the son of the poet had curtailed his stay somewhat and gone back to his ship the day before. That information touched me but little. Believing in heredity in moderation, I knew well how sea life fashions a man outwardly and stamps his soul with the mark of a certain prosaic fitness, because a sailor is not an adventurer. I expressed no regret at missing Captain Anthony, and we proceeded in silence till, on approaching the holiday cottage, Fine suddenly and unexpectedly broke it by the hurried declaration that he would go on with me a little farther. "Go with you to your door," he mumbled, and started forward to the little gate, where the shadowy figure of Mrs. Fine hovered, clearly on the lookout for him. She was alone. The children must have been already in bed, and I saw no attending girlfriend shadow near her vague but unmistakable form, half lost in the obscurity of the little garden. I heard Fine exclaim, "Oding," and then Mrs. Fine's well-trained responsible voice uttered the words, "It's what I have said," with incisive equanimity. By that time I had passed on, raising my hat. Almost at once Fine caught me up and slowed down to my strolling gait, which must have been infinitely irksome to his high pedestrian faculties. I am sure that all his muscular person must have suffered from awful physical boredom, but he did not attempt to charm it away by conversation. He preserved a portentous and dreary silence, and I was bored too. Suddenly I perceived the menace of even worse boredom. Yes. He was so silent because he had something to tell me. I became extremely frightened. But man, reckless animal, is so made that in him curiosity, the paltriest curiosity, will overcome all terrors, every disgust, and even despair itself. To my laconic invitation to come in for a drink, he answered by a deep, gravely accented, "Thanks, I will," as though it were a response in church. His face as seen in the lamplight gave me no clue to the character of the impending communication, as indeed from the nature of things it couldn't do, its normal expression being already that of the utmost possible seriousness. It was perfect and immovable, and for a certainty, if he had something excruciatingly funny to tell me, it would be all the same. He gazed at me earnestly, and delivered himself of some weighty remarks on Mrs. Fine's desire to befriend, counsel, and guide young girls of all sorts on the path of life. It was a voluntary mission. He approved his wife's action, and also her views and principles in general. All this with a solemn countenance and in deep measured tones. Yet somehow I got an irresistible conviction that he was exasperated by something in particular. In the unworthy hope of being amused by the misfortunes of a fellow creature, I asked him point blank what was wrong now. What was wrong was that a girlfriend was missing. As he had been missing precisely since 6 o'clock that morning. The woman who did the work of the cottage saw her going out at that hour, for a walk. The pedestrian Fine's ideas of a walk were extensive, but the girl did not turn up for lunch, nor yet for tea, nor yet for dinner. She had not turned up by footpath, road or rail. He had been reluctant to make inquiries. It would have set all the village talking. The Fines had expected her to reappear every moment, till the shades of the night and the silence of slumber had stolen gradually over the wide and peaceful rural landscape commanded by the cottage. After telling me that much, Fine sat helpless in inconclusive agony. Going to bed was out of the question, neither could any steps be taken just then. What to do with himself he did not know. I asked him if this was the same young lady I saw a day or two before I went to town. He really could not remember. Was she a girl with dark hair and blue eyes? I asked further. He really couldn't tell what color her eyes were. He was very unobservant except as to the peculiarities of footpaths, on which he was an authority. I thought with amazement and some admiration that Mrs. Fine's young disciples were to her husband's gravity no more than evanescent shadows. However, with but little hesitation, Fine ventured to affirm that yes, her hair was of some dark shade. We had a good deal to do with that girl first and last, he explained solemnly. Then getting up, as if moved by a spring, he snatched his cap off the table. He may be back in the cottage, he cried in his bass voice. I followed him out on the road. It was one of those dewy, clear, starry nights, oppressing our spirit, crushing our pride, by the brilliant evidence of the awful loneliness, of the hopeless obscure insignificance of our globe lost in the splendid revelation of a glittering, soulless universe. I hate such skies. Daylight is friendly to man toiling under a sun which warms his heart, and cloudy soft nights are more kindly to our littleness. I nearly ran back again to my lighted parlor, Fine fussing in a knickerbocker suit before the hosts of heaven, on the shadowy earth, about a transient, phantom-like girl, seemed too ridiculous to associate with. On the other hand, there was something fascinating in the very absurdity. He cut along in his best pedestrian style, and I found myself let in for a spell of severe exercise at 11 o'clock at night. In the distance over the fields, and trees smudging and blotching the vast obscurity, one lighted window of the cottage with the blind up was like a bright beacon kept alight to guide the lost wanderer. Inside, at the table bearing the lamp, we saw Mrs. Fine sitting with folded arms, and not a hair of her head out of place. She looked exactly like a governess who had put the children to bed, and her manner to me was just the neutral manner of a governess. To her husband too, for that matter. Fine told her that I was fully informed. Not a muscle of her ruddy, smooth, handsome face moved. As he had schooled herself into that sort of thing. Having seen two successive wives of the delicate poet chivied and worried into their graves, as he had adopted that cool, detached manner to meet her gifted father's outbreaks of selfish temper. It had now become a second nature. I suppose she was always like that, even in the very hour of elopement with Fine. That transaction, when one remembered it in her presence, acquired a quaintly marvelous aspect to one's imagination. But somehow her self-possession matched very well little Fine's invariable solemnity. I was rather sorry for him. Wasn't he worried? The agony of solemnity. At the same time, I was amused. I didn't take a gloomy view of that initial girl trick. Somehow I couldn't. But I said nothing. None of us said anything. We sat about that big round table, as if assembled for a conference, and looked at each other in a sort of fatuous consternation. I would have ended by laughing outright if I had not been saved from that impropriety by poor Fine becoming preposterous. He began with grave anguish to talk of going to the police in the morning, of printing descriptive bills, of setting people to drag the ponds for miles around. It was extremely gruesome. I murmured something about communicating with the young lady's relatives. It seemed to me a very natural suggestion. But Fine and his wife exchanged such a significant glance that I felt as though I had made a tactless remark. But I really wanted to help poor Fine, and as I could see that, manlike, he suffered from the present inability to act, the passive waiting, I said. Nothing of this can be done till tomorrow. But as you have given me an insight into the nature of your thoughts, I can tell you what may be done at once. We may go and look at the bottom of the old quarry, which is on the level of the road, about a mile from here. The couple made big eyes at this, and then I told them of my meeting with the girl. You may be surprised, but I assure you I had not perceived this aspect of it till that very moment. It was like a startling revelation, the past throwing a sinister light on the future. Fine opened his mouth gravely and as gravely shut it. Nothing more. Mrs. Fine said, "You had better go," with an air, as if her self-possession had been pricked with a pin in some secret place. And I, you know how stupid I can be at times, I perceived with dismay for the first time that, by pandering to Fine's morbid fancies, I had let myself in for some more severe exercise. And wasn't I sorry I spoke? You know how I hate walking, at least on solid, rural earth. For I can walk a ship's deck a whole foggy night through, if necessary, and think little of it. There is some satisfaction too in playing the vagabond in the streets of a big town till the sky pales above the ridges of the roofs. I have done that repeatedly for pleasure of a sort. But to tramp the slumbering countryside in the dark is for me a wearisome nightmare of exertion. With perfect detachment, Mrs. Fine watched me go out after her husband. That woman was Flint. The fresh night had a smell of soil, of turned-up sods, like a grave, an association particularly odious to a sailor by its idea of confinement and narrowness. Yes, even when he has given up the hope of being buried at sea, about the last hope a sailor gives up consciously, after he has been, as it does happen, decoyed by some chance into the toils of the land. A strong grave-like sniff. The ditch by the side of the road must have been freshly dug in front of the cottage. Once clear of the garden, Fine gathered way like a racing cutter. What was a mile to him, or 20 miles? You think he might have? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.